Hey, Anna, I've been thinking about time a lot lately.
Because you have too much of it on your hands.
Yeah, I mean, you know, being stuck at home for about a year, you know, that'll do it. So I came across a wild idea from the past, from one of our astronomers 100 years ago. He was advocating for a time zone, one time zone across the entire United States. So everybody from coast to coast would be on the same time. What do you think?
Actually, it makes a lot of sense now, because would that include like Canada and everybody? And
well, so it'd be like all American time. Exactly. It'd be all American time. So everywhere from, you know, the East Coast to the West Coast would be on the same time. So it'd be 9 o'clock in Cincinnati, 9 o'clock in LA, 9 o'clock in Dallas.
But then it would be like dark.
Well, there's the problem. And yeah, this was his idea. It's like, let's get everybody on the same time. So business is all done at the same time. So you don't have to worry about calling in the middle of the night to somebody because it's the same time and everybody's up.
I don't.
Well, the critics were not happy with this. And they said, no way. Sorry, Cincinnati Observatory astronomer. Good try. And he even came back and he said, you know, well, people won't like it for a couple days, but they'll get used to it after about 3 days.
Oh, 3 days is all I thought it would take?
That's all he thought it would take.
Oh, that is adorably optimistic.
I know. And yet the all-American time failed. Oh, well, we're stuck with our time zones.
Ridiculous.
From our makeshift home studios and Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory. This week, we are happy to welcome science communicator and PhD student in astrophysics at the University of California, Berkeley, Serafina Nance. All right, so first, we have some other podcasts like housekeeping to address. We want to give a shout out to Kevin Reynolds, he started the show. I've been a producer for a long time. Now moving on to a different role. Hopefully he'll still be involved. But don't you just love Kevin, Dean?
I know. We want to give a big thanks to Kevin Reynolds for all the work he did getting this podcast started and keeping us on track.
That's true.
We were a mess without Kevin, right? I mean, we could barely even string two sentences together.
I don't know.
We can do three sentences.
String two sentences together. I mean, he made this possible. Yeah, he made it so that we did this together. Can you imagine someone else doing this podcast with you? No, you can't.
No, I couldn't. I even when I pitched it to him, I wanted somebody else. But no, I can't picture it now because I know now I'm stuck with you. So here we go. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks a lot, Kevin. We're off the point. You're supposed to be like, Kevin made it all happen. This is amazing.
This is why you have to trust people at Cincinnati Public Radio because they make better decisions than astronomers when it comes to this thing. Pairing up me with you was genius, and so we want to thank Kevin for doing that. Yes, that was great,
and we're excited to work with Josh, who we've been working with, who's going to be producing the show now, and he's also amazing, and he edits everything to make us sound good since I don't know how to do any of that. And he's really helpful. And you don't know either, Dean. Sorry.
Exactly. No, I don't. This is great. Yeah. We're just two people in front of a microphone and Josh will make it all sound
literally all we can
great.
Do.
Well, as good as it can be at least. So thanks to Josh and for Kevin too.
Very, very lucky to have such a great team. So, you know, what else is happening?
Well, so again, I'm all focused on time here. I'm just thinking like, you know, it's been a year now. We've been in quarantine and time flies.
Like you should have a beer or something right now.
Well, I'm one of the lucky ones that, well, I don't know if it's lucky or not, but I, you know, learned to cut my own hair. So I've avoided the hippie look.
Are you serious?
And the bearded. Oh yeah, you know, I've been cutting. Well, what, you couldn't tell that I cut my own hair? I've been doing that for a long time.
I don't really look not that just much, since the, I'll be honest, but I not, now I'm going to
not, not just since the pandemic. This is I've had this haircut for a long time. Get the bowl out. It's all.
I was going to say, is it one of those that like a flowy? Is it like?
If I wish.
So yeah, but time, you're right. Time is a thing for sure, especially a year into this pandemic. God.
And as we're coming into March here, well, it's time for daylight saving time to come into effect. And I was just kind of curious, what's your take on daylight saving time? If you like it, don't like it, don't care about it.
Well, I have different feelings about the two different ones. I have different feelings about fall back than I do about spring forward. Although I'm going to be one of those people, it's kind of annoying, but I will say, as a parent, your kid doesn't know the difference. And so you always feel like, why does this matter? This is the same. They don't notice that it's fall back or spring forward. So not to be a martyr, but it's kind of annoying now both ways. It used to be fun to fall back because I would get an extra hour of sleep. Now I hate them both.
Yeah, because I never thought of it that way. So the young child wouldn't know the difference. So whether you fall back and you get an extra hour, extra hour. That kid's going to be up.
And then as long as they're going to sleep.
And if you spring ahead, you lose an hour. And they might sleep in an extra hour.
Oh. They don't.
I don't know. See if you can use this.
No. No.
Yeah,
what do you think? I mean, are you fine with it? I feel like you have a strong opinion. I'm not going to lie.
I this is one of those things I really don't care that much about. Surprisingly, because I usually would. But the only thing with daylight saving time is that it does push the sunset back. So that means that I have to do my job an hour later every night. So it gets darker an hour later and I get to stay up an extra hour later. But I also get to sleep in an extra hour. So that makes up for it.
Yeah, you do because you don't have children. So you're allowed to do what you
want. That's right, exactly. Oh, it's great.
So great.
Fall back. I fall back 5 hours on that day. Spring forward, though, I know you lose that extra hour. But then, it's one of those things, does it really save energy? Does it really do what it's supposed to? And there's lots of debates about that. And I think whether we had it or didn't have it, it wouldn't change much.
Yeah.
But
well, those winter haters, they're excited because it means summer's coming. Like, spring is coming.
Exactly.
I'm not a winter hater, but those people that are...
Exactly. And so, measuring the passages of time, we use days and weeks and months and years and all that. And one of the things you don't think about this too much, but there's astronomical origins to all that stuff. I mean, what is an actual day is the amount of time it takes for the Earth to spin once.
Right.
So the whole Earth below you is spinning at this tremendous velocity going around once. And so then you come back around to where you started from the day before. Isn't that kind of nice?
Absolutely. You clearly have thought a lot about this sort of romantic view of a day, but good for you. I like it.
Well, as I wake up every day in the same place doing the same exact thing over and over again, I got to come up with something to make it a little bit better.
No, it is nice.
But
it
that's what's
nice.
Actually happening.
I'm just kidding.
That's what's actually happening. And then now the only one of these time periods that's not really related to stuff in space is the week. So a month is, was originally put around the phases, the moon phases, the cycle that repeats itself once every month. Mm-hmm. And a year is the amount of time it takes for the Earth to go around the sun. But a week, where did that come from? Well, it's got a pseudo astronomical reference.
You're just going to make it astronomical.
It was definitely arbitrary and it was definitely human made and not exactly sure how far back the 7-day week goes. But when you look at the days of the week and their names, what are they named after?
The days of the week and their names.
So think Sunday.
Like the sun.
Monday.
The Mun.
The Mun, right. And Saturday.
Saturn. Oh, this is fun. Keep going. What are the other ones?
Well, those are the only three that make sense. The rest of them, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, well, that gets a little dicier. Yeah. But if you can think of French and Spanish, the names sound a little bit better.
Yeah,
so,
French is pretty, actually, I think.
Well, you know what happens on Fat Tuesday, right? I mean, what's that called?
Mardi Gras.
Wait, isn't that the same day?
Yeah.
Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras is...
Mercredi. I was a French minor in college. I don't even know the rest. Vendredi.
Jeudi.
Something and dimanche.
Well,
what's
right.
Saturday?
So, but you're right. So, I don't know. We're not talking French.
I'm sorry. I know. I get us up to the road all the time. Go ahead.
No, but I mentioned that. I opened that door and I wasn't prepared to go through it. But so Tuesday is Mars's day. Yes. So Mardi Gras.
Okay,
so that's Mars's
I'm
day.
On board.
Wednesday, Mercury is Mercury day.
Okay.
Thursday is Jupiter's day. So usually it starts with the letter J for Spanish and French. So Jupiter day.
Okay.
And then Friday is Venus's day. So Vendredi and Viernes for Spanish. Oh, look at that. I remember that one from Spanish. That's good. So so each day of the week had a planet, including the sun and the moon, because those were ancient planets from the ancient world. So each day of the week had its own special planet. So whatever day it is, wherever you are, you can celebrate that planet.
Oh, that's nice. That's really good. Samedi is Saturday in French. Oh, that was going to bother me.
Samedi.
Sorry.
Samedi. That's good. Glad you looked that up. That was good.
Sorry, but it was going to bother me. I like that you can make literally anything about astronomy. You're just like, don't worry. Each day of the week, you can look at a different planet. It's great.
Yep. TGIF Venus Day. We're obviously not going to patent that one. Well, we'll see what great conversations we're going to have a year from today.
Oh, let's hope we're not still in. I'm worried about you if we're still in quarantine.
I know. I'm going to have to come up with something better than what I just came up with there.
Bust out.
Serafina Nance is an astrophysicist and science communicator who specializes in supernovas and cosmology. She hosts the astronomy show Constellations and inspires thousands of people with her social media posts. Serafina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. What an intro. I'm honored. Thank you.
Oh, well, we're very excited to have you. And reading up a little bit, you were kind of born and raised Texas, born and raised, grew up listening to Stardate on radio there from the McDonnell Observatory. And then you get to work at the McDonnell Observatory. What is that like? This is on my bucket list of places to go visit as far as observatories.
Yeah, that's right. It was one of the most special experiences of my life. It's the darkest skies in the continental US. You walk out there, especially when there's no moon. And I mean, you can see it's what feels like billions of stars. It's so beautiful. I remember the first time I saw the Milky Way, I thought it was clouds because of how bright it was. And it was literally our galaxy stretching across the night sky. It was really, really, really special.
So we understand that you study Betelgeuse. Is it Betelgeuse? I always think that I should have some like fancier pronunciation of it. Like it's not the movie. Can you tell us a little bit about what interests you about Betelgeuse and kind of your research there?
Yeah, absolutely. So Betelgeuse is a red supergiant in the constellation Orion. And I think it's really cool because we can actually see it in our night skies. It's the left shoulder of the constellation, and it's really bright and really big and really red. And so we can actually like see the ruddy color of Betelgeuse from Earth, which I think is very cool. And the really interesting thing about this star is that it is so big that it will probably explode one day. And so since we can see it from Earth, there's a chance we would actually see the explosion from Earth as well. And so I got really interested in trying to find out when it was going to explode as a supernova.
Oh, wow. So Orion's going to blow out his shoulder, basically.
That's right. Exactly.
sounds like a problem. So have you figured out, or do you know, or you think you know?
I think we have an idea.
Okay.
One other thing I'll say about Betelgeuse, and just supernova astronomy in general, is that in astronomy, things change on really long time scales. You know, the universe is 13.7 billion years old. So it's really hard for humans to have sort of a connection to what's out there because, you know, we don't actually get to see it evolve and change.
Mm-hmm.
And transient astronomy, which are, you know, things like supernova, they change on a time scale that humans can understand. So they collapse and explode in a matter of seconds, and we can see that light change in a matter of months. So I think that's really neat because we can, you know, study the universe and we can have an idea of what's out there and see it change in sort of real time, other than sort of the space-time, time dilation, general relativity issue. So our models of Betelgeuse show that it probably won't explode for another 100,000 years or so, which, I know, bummer.
Oh, man.
I know, I know.
I was like getting ready, like thinking about like parties I could have and themes and I don't know.
I know, I know. And when it explodes, we'll, I mean, if we're still around, we would be able to see it from Earth. It would be as bright as the moon. It would be bright during the day. So we would have basically the second moon shining down on us for several months, which I think is very cool.
It is very cool.
Man, I was waiting for the date. I was waiting for September 3rd, 2023. I was like, I got the inside scoop here. Seraphina knows the day it's going to happen. Oh, man, 100,000 years. Oh, well.
I know. If only. There was a moment last year, I guess, end of 2019, early 2020, when we saw Betelgeuse start to fade a lot. And we thought, well, maybe that means it'll explode soon. And, you know, astronomy community, astronomy Twitter especially, was like going really, really wild about it. But turns out we don't think that's what's going to happen to stars before they explode. We think they'll actually get brighter before they explode. So
not dimmer.
Sadly, that didn't happen.
Well, I was reading about how You do some of the work with this to simulate, you know, kind of evolution of stars and supernova explosions using giant supercomputers. And whenever I hear the term supercomputers, I always think it's just like mine, except better and bigger. But what's it like working with, you know, how do you simulate this stuff and how do you try to like predict what a supernova will do?
That's a great question. I also didn't really know what a supercomputer was when I got to grad school. I was like, oh, there's a really big computer that I get to type on. And alas, that's kind of what it is. It's basically just a bunch of computers combined together. But, you know, I work pretty much exclusively on my laptop. And what I do is I sort of virtually connect to the supercomputer that's at the lab. But I run all of my code and all my simulations on my laptop, which is really neat. And simulating a supernova sounds really cool, but what it really is a bunch of math and a bunch of, let me put in random parameters, seemingly random parameters into my simulation and see what the code does with it. So, you know, those things can be as, you know, interesting as the velocity of the star, how fast it's rotating, can be the temperature, the luminosity. And so what we do is we try to choose parameters that are physically representative of the problem that we're facing. So, you know, I focus on parameters like temperature and luminosity, and then we see what happens and try to compare what our simulations say to what we actually observe when we point a telescope at the star. Hopefully that wasn't, I don't want to get too in the weeds. Hopefully that wasn't too complicated.
Great. Well, switching gears a little bit, our producer, Kevin, mentioned he follows you on Twitter and Instagram. Well, I follow you on Instagram as well. And I saw you just posted some exciting news that you are writing a children's book. Can you tell us a little bit about that? That's so exciting.
Thank you. I am very excited. I can't share too much yet, but I just signed a contract. The book's already written. And
oh, wow.
It will come out. Pre-orders should be out, I hope, in the next couple of weeks, and I can share more details as that comes up. But what I can say is that I really hope that it inspires young kids and gets them really interested in the topics that I am also interested in, i.e. astronomy. But yeah, I'm really excited about it.
That's awesome. Congratulations about that. That's great.
Thank you so much.
And we'll have to read the book because on the last page, it'll be the date Betelgeuse is going to explode. That's going to be the last page. You're going to put that in there, right?
Teen, give it up.
That's right. It'll be a little footnote.
You know, right. You got to sell these books, you know, like this is a good way to do it.
Oh, my God.
There will be little hints. throughout.
That's right.
Oh, right. It could be a code. Yeah, you can decode it. Oh,
like a cipher that you can like.
Well, so, you know, as a science communicator, and you do this in a lot of different methods, what do you think is, or what do you find is the most effective way of communicating science to the public? You know, what that the public really responds to well, and the one you like the best, too?
So I might answer this question a little bit differently than how you meant it. I think the way that I approach science communication is less about the medium that I use and more about the way that I communicate my message. And so the two things that I really focus on are trying to eliminate jargon from my speech and communicate with passion. Why should somebody care about the thing that I'm trying to talk about? So those are sort of like my two guiding principles. And then I try to apply them, you know, wherever I can. I think sort of inherently, I prefer to use the written form. So I really like writing. I've always wanted to be a writer to some extent. So, you know, Twitter is really great for me because I can kind of make sure I'm communicating the way I want to communicate. But I love, you know, I love speaking. I love talking to people. And so that's what I did at the McDonald Observatory, actually, is I was actually teaching sort of public viewings and things about space. And that was really cool because you get to interact with people. You get to show people why something is so neat.
In our last couple minutes here, can you talk to us a little bit about other projects that you're working on or things that you're excited for the rest of 2021, maybe?
Totally. So I'm currently applying to go to space. So that is my current project.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. St. Jude is basically creating the first all-civilian mission to space, and there are two seats available. So I am both raising money for St. Jude and trying to get my story out there with hereditary cancer and with astronomy, and sort of using this as a unique opportunity to advocate for women's health, advocate for genetic testing, and advocate for my passion for the cosmos.
That's well, so you got cool. my vote. Let's let's make this happen. We'll get you to Mars. That's I think.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'll take all the help I can get.
Be a great representative of our planet to go to Mars.
For sure.
I'm honored. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. This has been a lot of fun chatting.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a blast.
Our thanks to Serafina Nance for joining us today. You can find her on Twitter at StarStrickenSF or learn more about her work on our website at wvxu.org/lookingup.
Well, it's time for Quarantine Crank File. A year in and we still can do Quarantine Crank because the cranks never end. And this one comes from a fun little something that one of our volunteers, Don, found about time and Cincinnati. And Dean, why don't you share this little exciting tidbit with everybody and tell them what Mark Twain said about Cincinnati too.
So I want to thank our volunteer Don, who is turning into quite the historian here, finding some great gems back in the archives. So if we go back in time, 140 years, 150 years, each city had their own time. So if you traveled from city to city, it wasn't like there were giant time zones. You would have to like change your clock and your watch like a few minutes. So if you'd travel from Columbus to Cincinnati, Columbus would be on a different time than Cincinnati would. So
eventually
it got really confusing for the trains, because if you take a train from one town to the other, you might go back in time or you might go forward in time too far and then you miss your other connecting train.
Yeah, my head
like,
hurt.
Oh, well, this train only, yeah, it got super confusing. And so one of our early astronomers, Cleveland Abbey, really advocated for time zones to happen. You break down the time zones how we have them today with Eastern and Central and Mountain and Pacific. But later on, Cincinnati became really not a big fan of the standardized time. In fact, we were one of the last cities in the country to adopt standard time. We fought it vehemently.
What a surprise.
Whereas almost everybody adopted standard time about 1881, 1882. We did not in Cincinnati until 1890.
Are you serious?
So until all the people
1890?
8.5 really years we resisted. So anybody that traveled through Cincinnati had no idea what time it was when they came into town. They were like, wait, what? What time is it? Have I gone into like a wormhole or something? So this affected like not only the trains, but courts and merchants and hotels and everything. Restaurants.
But I was like, 1890.
It messed with everything. Yeah. So finally... Don found us this gem from the Cincinnati Inquirer, February 22nd, 1890, the day that time stood still in Cincinnati. And so the adoption of the city, the way they did this is that their time was off by 22 minutes based on everybody else. So people came into town, the clocks were 22 minutes off.
Okay.
So this is what happened. At noon today, standard time goes into effect in the city. When it's noon by city time, the city clocks will be stopped for 22 minutes, and then the fire bells will be rung for the noon hour. In consequence, today will be 24 hours and 22 minutes long.
Oh.
So everybody got an extra 22 minutes while we got the clocks all lined.
What would you do with your extra 22 minutes, Dean?
I'd probably waste it.
That's fair.
But they said people were so excited about this that they had parties, they had a musical program that was entitled "Is That Clock Right?"
Oh my God.
Because that's what everybody said when they came into Cincinnati. They said, "Is that clock right?" And so finally, we entered the modern age and became a standardized time here in Cincinnati, and that completely goes to that old saying that Mark Twain said about Cincinnati, which some people say he didn't really say it, but other people say he really did say it. But either way, it's pretty accurate.
I don't have beef with Mark Twain, but yeah, I think he said it.
That Mark Twain said, if the end of the world happens, he knows where he's going to go. He'll go to Cincinnati because everything happens in Cincinnati 20 years later.
Or 8.5 years.
Or 8.5 years when it comes to time. But there we go. They held the clocks for 22 minutes, and you got an extra 22 minutes that day.
Gosh. Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to Serafina and Nance for joining us today. And remember to visit our website, wvxu.org/lookingup, to connect to more of her work and to find past episodes of the show.
Do you have any topic or guest ideas for us? We'd love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or drop us a note at lookingup@wvxu.org.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're an Apple Podcasts user, we'd really appreciate a rating and comment. That helps people to find us. Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y ? From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recording and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. We're produced by Josh Elstro, with assistance to this episode by Kevin Reynolds. Jim Nolan provides additional web assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.